Warm, a high of 83, inland 76 near Lake Michigan. We do want to give you a heads up about the middle of the week. There is an excessive heat watch in effect Wednesday morning through Thursday night. Wednesday will be sunny, hot, and humid, a high of 96. The heat index near 113. Thursday will be sunny and excessively hot with a high of 99. Here are the current numbers. Wind northeast to 10, humidity high at 84%. 72 degrees Racine, 71 in Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. It is with a very special, exceptional sense of privilege and pleasure that I announce that my morning show guest today is none other than Jack Mitchell. And anybody who knows public radio, the history of public radio, and the history of Wisconsin public radio in particular, and anyone who listens to All Things Considered should know or needs to know the name Jack Mitchell, a really towering figure in the history of public radio, someone who was at NPR right from the start, who helped to shape All Things Considered, that afternoon news magazine that so many of us have listened to for so long, and then had a very significant role in the growth and development of Wisconsin public radio. And I'm so pleased that Jack Mitchell was willing to make time in his schedule to have a conversation about his career in public radio and specifically his legacy with Wisconsin public radio and what he sees in terms of the future role of public radio in all of our lives. Jack Mitchell, we welcome you to the morning show.
Well, it's great to be here. Thank you.
I want to mention that a long, long, long time ago, this would be back sometime in the late 80s or early 90s, I remember you coming to Kenosha and to WGTD and giving us the opportunity to meet you, and I appreciated that encounter so much, and one or two brief encounters we've had over the years since then, and I really feel privileged to be able to speak with you today. Tell our listeners, first of all, a little bit about where you come from originally and what first fueled your interest in being part of the world of radio at a time when I assume there was almost nothing on the horizon that was called public radio.
Oh, that's for sure. Well, I was born in Detroit and raised in the Detroit area, and I was old. This was 1941 when I was born, and so TV was not around yet, and I listened to a lot of radio and liked it a lot. And so it was things like the Lone Ranger and the Green Hornet and these shows that some of them came out of Detroit, and I was, this wasn't direct in a way, but when we moved to the Detroit suburbs in the 1950s, it happened that our next door neighbor was a man named Fred Foy, who was the announcer narrator of the Lone Ranger on radio. And so I got to know him, and I was interested in radio before that anyway, and I worked for him sort of as his assistant for a while. So that was the beginning of it, and he actually got me my first job in radio at a little FM station in Detroit. But It really happened when I thought I'd go be in commercial radio news. And I did a little bit of that, but I realized that it was pretty superficial. And it turns out that I was at the University of Michigan, which had an educational radio station called WUOM, the University of Michigan station. And I went to work for them for several years as doing more substantial news. And I found it much more satisfying. And as it turns out, the Public Broadcasting Act was under discussion. This was the Lyndon Johnson, part of the Great Society. And it was fomented by television. Public television or educational television was a pretty substantial operation, largely funded by the Ford Foundation. But they needed federal money to achieve the kind of hopes that they were thinking of. And so they set up something called the Carnegie Commission to look into setting up a structure for public television. And as it turns out, and this is sort of how it all played out for me, the University of Michigan did not have a public television station. It had a public radio station, or an educational radio station. And two of the people I worked for were not going to let that happen, that radio would have to be included in this, in the Public Broadcasting Act, which was supposed to be the Public Television Act. And so they went to work lobbying and to get this thing changed. And I was right there. I was with them. You know, I wasn't lobbying, but I was hear back what was going on and as they went off to Washington to talk to the various people. And so I made the decision at that point that I would sort of cast my hopes on this development, that if radio would get in it and I would be a part of it. And so I was also, the alternative was to become a professor. And so I got myself a PhD at the University of Illinois and was prepared to go either way. As it turns out, the Public Television Act was modified to become the Public Broadcasting Act. Radio was included reluctantly. But it was essentially understood that 10% of the money would go to radio, 90% to television. So that was I got myself acquainted with the people who were going to, I thought, run public radio nationally, and they seemed to like me, and so I was picked by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting to spend a year at the BBC in London, studying how they did things. And the idea was that I would come back and be part of the new national network, which turned out to be National Public Radio. And I did. And I came back from London in June, and in August, I was hired as the first employee of NPR, and then
and the rest is history.
We went from there. Yeah,
I'm curious. You mentioned that it was only with great reluctance that the Public Broadcasting Act was amended, so it would include radio, albeit at a very modest level of funding compared to what was going to be given to public television. Do you have any sense of what the source of that reluctance was? I mean, did they just not want to be bothered, or did they see something counterproductive in such a...
Yeah, it was money. Well, 10% of the money was 10% of the money, and television wanted it all. And they had done all the work. You know, they had done the lobbying. They had done all the research. They funded... They got the Carnegie Commission. That was their commission, you know. And then radio tried to sneak in the back door. And frankly, it was a little underhanded the way they did it, you know, lobbying behind the scenes, threatening to go public, threatening to scuttle the whole bill. You know, it was kind of empty threats because, you know, the power that educational radio had. It was very... you don't understand, nobody understands it now, how weak educational radio was. And it only existed in about maybe 25 states. The rest of the country didn't have it at all. And they were little university stations, often student-run and not terribly professional. It was, you know, it's a pathetic system compared to what television had been back in the 1960s. So it's not surprising that they thought it was a waste of money. But it turns out that there was probably more potential for public radio than there was for public television.
Absolutely. And, of course, I appreciate you sharing this particular facet of the story because it helps us even more deeply appreciate what came ultimately to fruition. Tell us a little bit about that year you spent in London studying the BBC. Coming back from there, did you find yourself, in a sense, equipped with really valuable lessons you learned there?
A couple of things. One, I worked on what they called magazine programs. They had four of them during the day on the BBC Radio 4. And I worked on two of them, the morning show and then their 11 o'clock at night, or I guess it was 10 o'clock at night show. And then they had a couple of others that I was I worked on them very briefly. But so I learned how that all works. Granted, they had big staffs, and when we got to NPR, there wasn't any. I knew what the basic magazine format, which became All Things Considered. I picked that up there. And the other thing was while I was there, they were going through a tremendous and rather painful transition from their old structure of radio, which was the home service, the light service, and the third program, which were basically all class level. The light service was of working class, the home service was for more middle and upper class, and then the third program, which was for the artist. And so they were going from that to formats. Radio 1, rock and roll. Radio 2, middle of the road music and sports. Radio 3, classical. Radio 4, talk. And so the notion of having complementary services was stuck in my head, and I brought that back. And I think in some respects that may have been I'm not saying if I hadn't brought it back, it wouldn't have happened anyway, but the idea of having multiple formatted stations that would serve different audiences, that was totally new for educational radio. Hmm. Educational radio was there to serve everybody or maybe serve nobody, but it was not certainly audience-oriented. And the notion of the dual service or multiple service programming became eventually the dogma of educational or public radio, including in Wisconsin.
Of course, in a really splendid way with the two networks of Wisconsin Public Radio, which you helped to oversee for many, many years. I had never heard the story of the possible genesis or one aspect of that in terms of where that idea came from.
It came from the BBC.
Hmm. Well, thank you, BBC. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking today on the morning show with Jack Mitchell, one of the most valuable contributors to the early days of National Public Radio. In fact, National Public Radio's very first employee back in 1970, and the very first producer for All Things Considered, which of course is still a proud part of NPR's daily programming, and also for many, many years director of Wisconsin Public Radio for more than 20 years. So Jack Mitchell, take us back to those days when you were literally the only employee of National Public Radio. I assume you were not the sole employee for terribly long, but...
For 3 weeks, I was at National Public Radio. I was hired by the person who was designated to be president, but he couldn't start until after Labor Day, and I was available, and so I started in early August, and then and so I ran the office. I scheduled a couple of meetings of the board, the NPR board, and made arrangements for that. And it's always just mechanical, clerical kind of things that
sure.
I was doing for those weeks.
Right. In that very, very early period when National Public Radio has just been created, how much difference of opinion was there in terms of exactly what this should be, or towards what goals should we be working? I mean, were there vastly and dramatically conflicting visions of what NPR was meant to be or should be?
Yeah, very, very good question, because in many ways there was no vision, because public television knew what it wanted to be, and there was some discussion there, arguments there about it should be, but deep down they all knew what they wanted. Radio, nobody had even thought about it. I mean, there was suddenly, because of the work of these couple of people, got snuck into the act, and suddenly there was $1 million there to use, and nobody really knew, had that much thought about what it should be, except that it had to be a live network. It wasn't going to be, because educational radio distributed programming on tape by mail, and this was going to be live, interconnected, just like NBC and CBS. That we knew, but that was about it. And it was basically the lack of vision that was most impressive, which allowed somebody like me to have some influence. I was only 28 or so. I was young. Mm. And I could have influence because there was nobody else. And I'd been to the BBC. I had some ideas. I knew a little bit. But it did. It was a peculiar situation.
Right.
I think most people thought it should be basically just like educational radio, only a little better, more money spent on programs, higher quality. And educational radio back then was a lot of 15-minute and half-hour programs that were quite specialized, mostly interviews of one sort or another. A lot of it came from European broadcasters. And then the thing that actually people listened to on educational radio was classical music. So there were a big contingent of people who thought that we ought to basically just emphasize the classical music. That was not viable because in the legislation, this was part of the Great Society, and educational television was promising to do all kinds of, journalism, discussions, representing the minorities, being very inclusive. It was going to be for everybody, and to decide you're going to be a classical music service isn't for everybody. It serves a few people very well, but most people not at all. So it had to be something different from that. And there's a man who is actually from Wisconsin named Bill Siemering, who was this saintly man. He's just a wonderful human being who had dreams of a better society, and he was very poetic in the way he wrote. And he wrote the founding document for NPR. He was on the board of directors, which was talked about very much the same kinds of things as the Carnegie Commission, about bringing all kinds of people together. Because radio in those days, of course, it was formatted. And so you had your country station, you had your black-oriented station, you had your middle of the road, you had your all the talks, had all these specialized for different audiences. And he wanted to have this place that was for everybody. And it was beautiful. How you were going to do that was a little vague, but he had people, he could get people in tears about his, this wonderful vision of what we could all be. And that was adopted as our philosophy, that we will basically something that brings everyone together, not individual programs for different audiences, which is what educational radio did or what might have done and what public television tried to do, but a programming that would be for everybody all the time. And today, inclusion, diversity, etc., but those phrases were not anywhere on the radar back in 67, 68, when all this was coming together. So he was made program director, and he then, after months of trying to figure out how all this was supposed to work, they kind of threw up their hands and said, well, somebody has to be in charge of this. And so he appointed me to try to make sense of all this with all things considered. Mm. And I was the first producer, but for the first 9 or 10 months of All Things Considered, there was no producer.
Mm. And probably if we could hear examples of some of those first shows, we might not be surprised to hear that, I suppose. That there was...
No, it was a mess.
Right, or a free-for-all, or a little of both.
Yeah, free-form. Shall we say free-form? But I used to say that whoever got to work the first thing in the morning would decide what that program was going to be that day.
Hmm.
And there were many among the staff, there were all kinds of different agendas.
Absolutely.
So I was given the job of trying to pull it all together, and sort of did.
Hmm. By the way, I've heard a rumor that one of the most important meetings in terms of either organizing NPR or maybe specifically putting together All Things Considered, that such a meeting might have occurred at the Wingspread Conference Center on the north side of Racine. Does that sound familiar to you?
Yeah, it wasn't All Things Considered, but the original board that included Carl Schmidt, who was the director of educational radio in Wisconsin, who was one of my predecessors, he was a very influential member of the board. He is the one who brought Seemering onto the board because they met at Wingspread for one of their organizing meetings before we went on the air.
Mm,
but there were several important meetings that they had where they tried to sort out the philosophy, and where Seemering eventually emerged as the spokesperson for these people who were, there were personality feuds and, you know, long-time rivalries between this state university and that state university, and they lost in football back in 22, you know, all this stuff. It was all backward-looking. But Seemering was forward-looking.
Mm. By the way, I made a note of what I believe is a quote from Mr. Seemering from back in those days, talking about what this new thing called National Public Radio could be, at one point saying, it would reflect the diversity of America and let the country hear itself.
Yep, that's Seemering.
Mm. Yep. I can see what you mean about him being an inspiring figure and one looking forward. And it's interesting to think about words like that being said during as turbulent a period in our nation's history as the late 60s into the early
70s. Well, that 70s. Was the whole thing. It was very divisive, and that's why it was so important. He was head of the educational radio station in Buffalo, New York, and they had this standard student demonstration. It was closed down the campus over the Vietnam War, and he put on a program in which he had the administrators of the university and the students together and had tried to take the mediator's role in all that, just try to figure out where they agreed. And, you know, that was the notion of breaking down the barriers to become a place where agreements were negotiated. In black and white, you know, he set up a studio in the black ghetto in Buffalo to make sure their voices were heard. So he was innovative, you know, and it was more, if you look at the reality of what they actually did, it wasn't all that wonderful, but it was certainly the right idea. He was trying to do the to make a difference in the world, you know, with a terribly divided world.
Right. So when it came to this brand new program called All Things Considered, as part of the schedule of this fledgling thing called National Public Radio, as you've already talked about, you were brought in after a time of kind of creative chaos, shall we say, to try to bring some order to it and maybe formulate some kind of format that would give the program more sense of order and identity and so on. How difficult was it to do that? I mean, I am guessing that your efforts were not universally welcomed by those who were being directly impacted by them.
That's right. There were a couple of people who refused to work for me and seemingly said, okay. And so they went off on their own. He was a very sweet man. I think people were looking for some kind of a direction, and I had a few people who understood what I was thinking, and Susan Stamberg being the most important. She was a tape editor. She was not on the air, or she did a few things on the air, but mostly she was just she had a similar vision, and I made her host of the whole program. She was a half-time employee of the organization. And I made her host, and there were others who were understanding, but a few weren't. And of course, the stations mostly they just wanted something that was made sense. And after about a year after I took over, we had the annual public radio conference, and the first one had been just after the show started, and they were brutal about criticizing what was going on, and I was at that thing and took a lot of that. Seymour took more of it. But then the next year, after we'd gotten the thing more or less together, the tone, everybody was so grateful that finally there was some structure. And it wasn't what everybody wanted. In fact, it wasn't what anybody wanted. But at least it had some kind of form to it. And the simple things, like in the beginning, the newscast would be anywhere, because maybe the news wasn't the most important thing that happened today. Maybe a guy got a job in Racine who was unemployed. He got a job. Maybe that should be what we should start with. And I said, nice idea, but no, we're going to start with the news. And so we fixed the newscast, one at 5 o'clock and the other at 6 o'clock. And they'd be there every day at the same time. It was make it dependable. It's like make it radio. And that's really radio's habit. And so you have to have a form and a structure.
Right. Yeah. Well, and of course, and the other thing is, again, you're talking about things like dependability and form and structure at a time when a whole lot of people, including a whole lot of creative people, did not necessarily think within those concepts of dependability and form and structure. And it's an intriguing sort of clash of worlds. And fortunately, something extraordinary emerged from it. Could we talk for just a moment about Susan Stamberg and I think even beyond that, just the significance of voice and personality in terms of radio? And and what you were thinking about when, for instance, you made this choice for Susan Stamberg, who, of course, now is so indelibly linked to All Things Considered and public radio in general, but, of course, also in some respects, as you've already alluded to, was a somewhat unconventional choice for such a position.
Yeah. She was the first woman to host a national program of that sort. There were women's programs, but a program that was for the general audience. But she was also, she had a rather strong Bronx accent. I mean, she was not your neutral golden voice. She had a nice voice. It was kind of a cigarette-laden voice, but it was memorable, deep. And but the thing that I about her is that she really communicated with listeners. She wasn't just wasn't just reading a script, and that's so much of what I hear today is that. But she was an engaged person, and she would write her own scripts. But she would, when she was talking to somebody, she really wanted to get into inside of them, and she didn't just go through a prepared list of questions. And she, so she had this writing style that was very strong, but her interviewing and just the fact that she was not reading, and she was reading, but she didn't sound like she was reading. It's interesting, her co-host in the earliest days was Mike Waters, who had a wonderful voice, but he just was not able to read, and so he talked, and he would look at what he was supposed to say, and he would scribble a few notes, but it wasn't sentences, and then he would just speak, and beautifully, and eloquently. This was something of a handicap in terms of trying to hand him material. But between Susan and Mike, these were two people talking to you, not reading to you.
Mm.
And that was important to me, that we have that. But she was also a woman. And the fact that was very, very controversial. And I have a memo from the president of NPR saying, this is, we should use her a different way. She is not what we want as a host. But Seemring disagreed, and I disagreed, and we just ignored him.
Mm.
And went ahead. But he was reflecting the station's impact. You know, he's the one that took the complaints from the stations, and he was reflecting that. But it was controversial, but it didn't matter very much because we didn't have any listeners.
Hmm.
So, you know, we did this radical thing, but nobody much knew because nobody much listened.
Right.
We only had about 2 million people nationally.
And of course,
across the whole country in our audience. And, well, okay, that sounds like a lot in your living room, but it's, you know, by mass media style, you know, standards, it's not exactly mass.
Well, that changes, of course, over the course of time in pretty dramatic fashion. By the way, is there very much in the way of recorded legacy from those very, very early and somewhat chaotic years of...
Every program was taped.
Wow.
And I think it's all... It's either in the Library of Congress or... I think it's the Library of Congress, hasn't it?
It would be interesting to do some investigating and hear NPR in its infancy help us appreciate where it has come today.
Yeah. Well, some of it was brilliant. I mean, there were great moments in those early days, but it was not consistent.
Right. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking today with Jack Mitchell, who was actually employee number one for National Public Radio back in 1970 and very much helped to shape NPR's All Things Considered. And in our last few minutes, I want to talk about the next chapter of your life, which is when you became director of Wisconsin Public Radio. If what I'm reading is correct, that was the year 1976, and you served Wisconsin Public Radio for just over 20 years. Can you tell us a little bit about that shift from Washington, D.C. to the middle of Wisconsin? And what kind of a drastic shift, how drastic a shift was that? I mean, did you feel like you were moving to another planet?
No. I'm from Detroit. I started at the University of Michigan radio station. I did work in Wisconsin for a year before I went to the BBC. I was here in Madison. So I was, I think it was called Public Affairs Director of the station, and did public affairs types programs. And so I was familiar with the place. NPR was going through a tremendous growth pains. Within a year after I left, the vice president, the president were both fired. A new board of directors came in. They hired a new president, Frank Mankiewicz. And so what I had, I could see that I was not going to be as a bigger factor in NPR if I even lasted, because who knows what the new people would want to do. So I knew I had to leave, or I should leave. And then I was offered, the manager of WHA Radio in Madison died, and her boss, who I had known in Madison, asked me to come back as manager. And it was really quite wonderful in a way, because at NPR, everything was terribly political and fraught with difficult personalities, talented personalities. But it came back to Madison, which was a very calm, settled place. And I unsettled it, but when I came back, it was extremely peaceful, very nice.
Hmm. So tell us about unsettling Wisconsin public radio. I have a pretty good idea of what you're talking about, but maybe our listeners don't.
Yeah. Well, it was unlike NPR. WHA and the state radio network continued to be a series of 15-minute, half-hour programs. The philosophy was, let's have a music program followed by a talk program. It was one after, it was interspersed. It was 15 minutes music serenade, and then 15 minutes of Belgian press review. It was extreme, but that's kind of where they were. And so I wanted to format like the BBC. And so the politics nobody wants to care about and cares about, but basically the idea was that we would have a classical music station and a talk station. And we would sort all this stuff out. It meant a lot more programming, because we're doubling the amount of programming. But we're also simplifying it, and instituted several magazine programs, or tried to, which were sort of a poor man's All Things Considered in the morning, and another one at noon, that were incorporated a lot of what WHA had been doing, and doing wonderfully. It was the best public radio station in the country prior to NPR. Biggest budget. It was the pioneer. It gave us people like Carl Schmidt and Bill Seemring. They came out of Wisconsin. So it was a good place, but a very stuck in the past place. It hadn't really changed since the 1950s, and we tried to format it and change. Make it more listener friendly.
It's interesting, as you were describing the early days of National Public Radio, and also in a sense describing Wisconsin Public Radio, maybe this is true to a lesser extent, I'm reminded of what little I know about the early days of commercial television. And of course I wasn't alive then, but from what I understand, especially the very, very earliest days of commercial television, were kind of a mess in terms of from day to day what would happen, and it would just be this crazy quilt. I mean, crazy, yeah. In very literal sense, and absolutely no overarching sense of what this network should represent or who is listening when. And it stands to reason, I mean, with this brand new thing that has just been created. And so I suppose in some respects we shouldn't be the least bit surprised that the early days of, for instance, public radio would be fraught with some of that same confusion, that same sense of who are we or what should we be.
Yeah, Yeah, what should we be? That's the issue, isn't it? We could be anything, or we thought we could be, and different people had different ideas of what that ought to be. But you had to reject a lot of ideas. You can't, one station was advocating that we do a national farm show. Well, okay, not a terrible idea, except that farming is different in Florida than it is in Minnesota. Hmm. And, you know, it's not probably something you should do nationally. But that was an idea. Hmm. And, as I said, there were some not necessarily screwy ideas, but you just couldn't do all that.
Right.
Especially NPR. We had no money. We got 10% of the CPB pot, but it wasn't really that much money. And we were terribly understaffed. It's miraculous to me. The All Things Considered staff, it was me and an associate producer and about four production assistants. That was it. Plus, we had the reporters we could call on. But it was very, very, it was high intensity. And that was one of the things that sort of overwhelmed a lot of us.
Sure. Although I imagine you maybe look back on those days with a certain amount of affection.
Absolutely.
In the same way that a lot of married couples sometimes look back at the early days when money was tight and we didn't have real furniture and but we made it somehow. You know, we made it together.
Yeah. No, it was the most exciting moment, period of my life, because you were just scratching it out and. You know, you were barely get on the air sometimes, and it was it was touch and go often, but there was a vision, and that did, and people believed in it. Mm. I mean, the folks, well, not everybody, I suppose, but the folks that worked most directly with me, they were as committed as I was to making this thing work, and they put an awful lot of work into it, and were never quite appreciated enough.
Sure.
The one person who's still around from that time is Ira Flatow, who does Science Friday.
Yes.
NPR. Ira was one of Siemering's students in Buffalo who came to work for us. Real bundle of energy, wonderful young man who wanted to be on the radio. Mm. And part of my job was keeping him off the radio because he sounded like a 12-year-old. And so he was, I can do this. Yeah, well, we'll get something. You can write the script. And we'll, you know. But he finally did get on the radio, and he's done very well, and he's still at it.
I was just going to say, he got on the radio and then some. And,
he's
absolutely great. Let's go back to Wisconsin Public Radio because I want to just ask you about the fact that, you've touched on the fact that NPR couldn't do everything for, the whole nation. I mean, you have to kind of think within certain boundaries of possibility. Right. When it comes to even within just the borders of Wisconsin, we're still talking about a sizable state and quite distinct in terms of extreme rural Wisconsin versus the heart of the metropolitan Milwaukee area, for instance.
Sure.
And how does Wisconsin Public Radio serve that whole population and, of course, even beyond its borders? But what did you think most about as director of Wisconsin Public Radio in terms of who you were serving and how best to serve them?
Yeah, very, very important. The educational radio philosophy was, we are here in Madison. We have wisdom and much, much good stuff, and we are going to share it with everybody else. That was, the education. No, we were educate the state. Public radio was to be more community-oriented. And so in addition to the dual service, two networks, it was important to me, and probably more important to me than almost anybody else because it never quite caught on. I wanted to have significant regional operations. And so we got pissed, and we did it mostly by taking over underperforming university stations, WGBH or WGBW in, at the University of Wisconsin Green Bay, had a radio station, and they didn't do much with it. And so we said, well, we'll take it over. We'll run it for you. And we'll have two services there. We'll have the one we put on WGBW and the one we've put on the WPNE, which is the big station up there. And so we did that, and I spent maybe 10 years going around the state trying to set up these arrangements. And we did it just about everywhere. Never pulled it off in Milwaukee. Which is, you know, obviously the most important market in the state, but everywhere else we have originally we had the morning host, the morning edition host was in the region. They weren't in, it wasn't in Madison. There was a person in Madison who served Madison, but in Stevens Point we had a person up there who was the morning edition host. It was her and Bob Edwards were the two folks because I figured that. In the morning, people want, first of all, local weather, but just the sense of that there's a real person who's their representative. And so that regional operation, the idea of regional centers, that rather never took off after I left. The other people who succeeded me didn't see that as very important. It never went away, but it never prospered either. And we'll see how it evolves. I mean, your station, WGTD, which is affiliated with the network, is more independent. You know, it's your program. I mean, that doesn't exist in the other stations that are part of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Right, and we have a morning news director who, in a sense, anchors our local newscasts in the midst of Morning Edition to give a wonderful balance of the national versus the state versus the local, and I can appreciate the vision with which you did that. Here's a last...
That's what it should have been.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And maybe will be. Yes. Maybe will be yet.
Here's a last question. I know that one of the things that is a reason why probably you love radio as much as I love radio is the strong connection we have to listeners, even though we never see them, even though typically they never even see our faces, but they hear our voices in their living rooms. It does mean that an audience feels a certain sense of ownership and also will be likewise then sometimes resistant when you're suddenly moving program X or eliminating program X or flipping this over to there. And it's like we are disrupting people's lives in a way that
we are. It's that people will depend on it.
Right.
You pull this plug out from under them, you know, it's understandable.
Right.
And I certainly experience a lot of it.
So how did you ultimately kind of come to terms with that part of the job?
You just have to have something of tough skin, which I don't have, actually, but I put it on. You have to assume that the decisions you are making are going to be better in the long run, and ultimately you're going to serve more people. And ultimately, even the people that are criticizing you are going to like what they're going to get. They're losing something, but they'll like what they get better. And it basically works. I mean, there are many changes, but look at the size of the audience. Our statewide audience when I came in 76 was 60,000 people. Now it's, I don't know what it is now, over close to 500,000. You know, the changes, no, they're not all because of me by any means, but it was that changes were made, demographics changed, FM radio changed. That was a big factor on it, that FM radio surged in the 1970s and 80s at the same time public radio was beginning. If Congress had not mandated FM radios in cars, which it did, public radio might never have really taken off the way it did.
funny the things to which we need to be grateful for in terms of what we now take for granted. Well, Jack Mitchell, I know a lot of public radio listeners are deeply appreciative of the role that you played at the outset at National Public Radio and the role you played for so many years as the head of Wisconsin Public Radio. And on their behalf, I thank you, and I thank you also for being my guest on The Morning Show. What a pleasure to speak with you again. Best wishes to you.
Thank you.